Support for this podcast comes from Wise, a universal account for over 50 currencies. Wise is the only account you need to go global. Whether you're converting pesos to pounds or dollars to dong, Wise makes it easy to manage your money across borders. You always get the real exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees, helping you save on currency conversion wherever your money takes you. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving. Learn more about how Wise could work for you at wise.com/world.
Since the Taliban took over in Afghanistan nearly a year ago, they've set the clock back for women. Just leaving your home without a man can now lead to imprisonment. Some Afghan women refuse to be silenced.
The net was closing in on her. Her friends had been imprisoned. Yet she continued to go out and protest.
Also today, the U.S. Secretary of State is touring Africa, a counterweight to Russian and Chinese ambitions. Israel's military and Palestinian militants hammer away at each other again. And we take a deep dive into why wars start and how they end.
You know, at least for the last 50, if not 60 years, wars have been very, very difficult to win. I mean, the last victory, true victory, was World War II.
Plus, the star turned for South African rapper Moonchild Sanelli, all coming up here today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for starting the week with us. Late last month, it was the Russian foreign minister touring Africa. Now it's the U.S.'s turn. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is visiting South Africa, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Rwanda. Alex Vines is following Blinken's trip. He directs the Africa program at Chatham House. So is the timing of Blinken's trip so soon after Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov? Was that planned, or is this just a coincidence?
No, Blinken's trip was planned. It's been long planned. The trip to South Africa is designed for the unveiling of a U.S. policy statement for future Africa policy for the United States. That's been in the works for over a year. And then it just made sense for Blinken to then go on to the Democratic Republic of Congo and to Rwanda.
When Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov visited countries in Africa, he tried to persuade them that the war in Ukraine was not the reason for cutoffs in crucial grain exports. He also seemed intent on shoring up allies for Russia with some African countries that were staying neutral on the war in Ukraine. What does Blinken have to say about all of this?
Africa is important for the numbers game in any international fora. I mean, look at it this way, 25% of the UN General Assembly are African. I mean, there are 55 African states. So therefore, it's inevitable that Africa is now prioritized, especially in intense shuttle diplomacy that the US is doing to both contain Russia. But actually, this trip is also about containing China. It's not just about Russia.
Russia can always offer grain and food to nations in Africa right now. What can the U.S. offer?
The U.S. can offer choice. It can offer project finance. It's still a very large player for humanitarian aid. There is room for the United States. A country like the Democratic Republic of Congo is also strategic to the U.S., which is looking at strategic and critical minerals and doesn't want those to be locked in by China or Russia for that reason.
Right. And Blinken is making a stop in the Democratic Republic of Congo. I mean, aside from creating and maintaining a doorway to natural resource extraction, what's happening in Congo that the U.S. is interested in?
Well, there is a resurgence of insecurity in eastern Congo. There is 120 armed groups in the eastern Congo, and one of them, called M23, is conducting military operations. It's challenging the UN, and it looks as if it may have also drawn in another US ally, Rwanda. So the US will want to use its own good offices to try and get both sides, Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, to kind of dial down and try and reduce the tension there. Bear in mind also, the US is a major contributor to the UN budget, including peacekeeping, and there is a major UN peacekeeping operation in eastern Congo.
So if it's about security for DRC, what can the U.S. offer? Or do you think this U.S. interest in Africa is about just providing a counterweight to Russia and China in this particular moment?
Well, it's knocking heads together. Both the Rwandan government and the Democratic Republic of the Congo one have been leaning more towards the U.S. Certainly, Rwanda is close to the US, and the United States has other interests tied to Rwanda. For example, Rwandan troops are deployed in northern Mozambique combating an insurgency there by Islamists. Exxon has large gas interests there that it wants to make a final investment decision. So this gets way more strategic than just the countries themselves.
Blinken is also visiting South Africa. What's going on there that warrants a stop?
Well, South Africa is a major anchor state. It's one of the big African countries' powers. And it, historically, the party of government, the African National Congress, has been pretty ambivalent about the United States. It regularly issues resolutions condemning the US for imperialism and neo-imperialism. And so this is an effort to try and improve the relationship with South Africa.
Mm. Ultimately, though, Alex, without new money, is the U.S. fairly limited in what it can do in Africa as a counterweight to China and now Russia?
Yeah, money really talks. I mean, the difference between the U.S. and Russia is that the U.S. does have deep pocket and it has staying power and it has scale. Russia, to be honest, is not the former Soviet Union. It travels lightly. So it can be mischievous. It can do things in certain places, but it can't stay the course in the way the U.S. can. Or indeed actually what China can. And so the longer-term competition will be between the U.S. and China, not with Russia.
So what are you going to be watching most closely as this competition unfolds and secretaries of state and foreign ministers go back to their capitals?
Yeah, I mean, I think international voting and which countries vote which way. I tend to think they'll go increasingly a la carte, so they will pick and choose certain resolutions they will abstain on. Sometimes they won't even show up. They'll go just miss the vote and have a coffee. And sometimes they will vote.
Alex Vines is the director of the Africa program at Chatham House. He joined us from London. Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
In Kenya, voters tomorrow will go to the polls to elect a new president. Political candidates have been making their final pitches for support with huge rallies across the country. A massive rally at Kasarani Stadium on the outskirts of Kenya's capital, Nairobi, this weekend. Kenya's election comes as the new U.S. ambassador to the country, Meg Whitman, is just arriving to begin her new assignment. From Nairobi, the world's Halima Gikandi reports.
Ambassador Meg Whitman spoke with reporters for the first time as ambassador on Sunday morning. Yes, that's the same Meg Whitman who served as a top executive at eBay, Hewlett-Packard, and other major corporations. This is her first diplomatic post, and she says her professional experience is one of the reasons President Biden nominated her.
I think my business background can be very helpful to an important agenda item for both our countries, which is improved economic trade and development.
Whitman's arrival comes in the midst of a flurry of U.S. diplomatic activity on the continent, and she says this is not a coincidence.
One out of every four people on Earth in 2050 will live on the African continent, and that Kenya is one of the most important countries in Africa. So I think, if you will, the flurry of diplomatic activity is a recognition of the importance of Africa.
The U.S. and Kenya have a long diplomatic relationship, and Kenya hosts the regional offices of many big American companies, like Facebook, which has recently been criticized during Kenya's election season for not doing enough to stop hate speech. Whitman says that is something she can work on as ambassador.
You know, I have a long background in Silicon Valley. Many of these companies are in Silicon Valley. So as I understand deeply the challenges here in Kenya, I want to make sure that the companies who are responsible for these platforms also understand the positive and the negative effects.
Kenya has also been a linchpin for stability in the region and a U.S. partner in security. That's one reason why Washington is paying close attention to Kenya's election.
Our embassy team has been preparing for the last 18 months alongside Kenyan institutions, the religious leaders, civil society, and also, of course, the government.
Meg Whitman emphasized that the United States wants to play a supportive role, but ultimately it will be for Kenya's government to provide free and fair elections. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
It's no secret food is at the heart of many cultures and identities across the globe. Michael W. Twitty has dug deep into the Venn diagram of two distinct food cultures. Twitty is a culinary historian and author of a new book called Kosher Soul. It explores the marriage of the global Jewish diaspora and a region known as the African Atlantic. The World's Bianca Hillier spoke with Twitty to hear more.
One of Twitty's most well-known and central ideas is that your food is your flag.
Not everybody has the kind of identity where it's a one-stop shop, you know? Some people's identities are spread out over borders and boundaries.
He says his flag is full of hot peppers, chicken, brisket, kasha varnishkas, and burekas.
How we identify with certain foods and cooking methods and traditions and festivities and seasons is our virtual flag. It is the sum total of who we are.
For Twitty, a Black Jewish man from the South, that means exploring food from the African Atlantic and Jewish diaspora civilizations in his new book, Kosher Soul. He uses the term African Atlantic to identify countries affected by the transatlantic slave trade, including Brazil, Portugal, the U.S., and those in the Caribbean.
For me, this book is like a culinary biography of the intersection between my Jewish peoplehood and my Blackness.
When writing the book, Twitty said he treated readers as though they were guests at his kitchen table. He tells those guests, so to speak, how Jews of color are not outliers, but meaningful creators in both civilizations. The book also includes interviews with cooks who share how food and faith intersect in their lives.
And what I want people to understand and notice is that we do have things that we hold in common that are deeply part of us, that are not divisive, that are very strongly unifiers, but we have to be able to look for them and understand they're always around us.
Of course, Kosher Soul is also full of recipes, from matzah meal fried chicken to Kosher Soul spring rolls to mac and cheese kugel. Twitty rejects the term fusion food because he doesn't want people to think these dishes are some trend or thoughtlessly smashed together.
Sometimes Kosher Soul is very simply the food of the African diaspora that's kosher. And sometimes it's incorporating food from Jewish diaspora into a meal that is African diaspora forward. And then sometimes it's just me or someone else playing around in the kitchen and deciding that flavors will work together if you really understand them. And all of a sudden you'll come up with matzo ball soup that has a Senegalese peanut butter base.
That soup is in the book too. And like every other dish, it's packed with meaning.
It tells a story of Jews who were escaping the Inquisition, who went south to Senegal. It tells a story of all the flavors from Morocco to Senegal to Spain to Tunisia that have a very similar origin. It also tells the story of my own lineage, you know, being part Senegalese, being part Jewish.
Just hearing about these recipes made me eager to try them. In my kitchen, I decided to make the black-eyed pea hummus.
Okay, tahini and now lots of spices. We're going to need sweet or smoked paprika.
The ingredients are similar to traditional hummus, but instead of chickpeas, Twitty uses black-eyed peas, a type of bean from West Africa. The final result was a thick and creamy hummus full of flavor.
Mmm, that is so good.
As I ate, I read what Twitty wrote about the recipe. He shares how black-eyed peas migrated with people from West Africa through the Nile River Valley to the Fertile Crescent. They're now a fixture in dishes from Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Palestine, and Jordan. Overall, Twitty adds that Jewish food and Black or African food can't be narrowly defined.
They are ever-changing, ever-evolving, ever-growing.
With Kosher Soul, Twitty is saying that the intersection of the African Atlantic and the global Jewish diaspora exists and should be celebrated.
Everything I write is resistance against amnesia, against annihilation, erasure. Our job is to make sure we don't get minimalized by being as maxi as possible.
Kosher Soul comes out tomorrow, August 9th. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Just ahead, the plight of Afghan women under 12 months of the Taliban. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 1 year after taking power in Afghanistan, the Taliban are attempting to erase women from public life. Women who travel unaccompanied by a man risk being imprisoned for so-called moral crimes. Young Afghan women who appear outside the home are sometimes followed, then forced to marry Taliban soldiers. Some who resist simply disappear. Documenting Taliban cruelty towards women is extremely dangerous, but a new television documentary does just that. Ramita Navai, a correspondent for PBS Frontline, managed to travel inside Afghanistan in recent months to interview women and Taliban officials. Her new documentary, Afghanistan Undercover, airs tomorrow night on PBS. Navai spoke with my colleague, Carol Hills.
Ramita, one of the cities you went to was Herat in western Afghanistan, and there you met a family whose daughter you call Mariam. She'd gone missing, right?
She'd just disappeared from the streets as far as they could tell. They found out that she'd been imprisoned. This was happening to many girls. The Taliban were not recording any of these imprisonments officially. So these girls, they just disappear into this black hole and they're stuck in this prison system with no one knowing where they are.
Now, in the case of Mariam, she was arrested, it turns out, for riding in a taxi without a male relative. You visited the prison she was being held in. In the jail's courtyard, you recognize her based on photos her mother had shown you. Here's that moment.
How are you doing?
I spoke in English so the guards wouldn't understand.
Why have you been taken?
21 days.
And what for? What crime?
They don't let us to speak. When we speak, they would punish us, okay? So just...
Mariam tells you she's been held for 21 days, and then she adds, they don't let us speak. If we speak, they would punch us, okay? Ramita, what sort of risk was she taking by talking to you?
Oh, a huge risk. So she was eventually freed, and we spoke to her at length, as well as four of her friends who'd also been imprisoned. They all told the same story, that they were beaten, they were all tasered, and that in prison, girls were offered a way out, freedom in return for marrying Talibs. And Mariam told me that four young women she knows of had to do this.
And as I understand it, some of these women, and in some cases girls, are becoming brides to men like 40 years older than them. I mean, what is their life like?
This is forced marriage where Taliban fighters and commanders abduct girls and women and force them into marriage without the consent of their parents and without any bride price. And what we found was really shocking, because we found that it's not just the foot soldiers doing this, that it's high levels. What usually happens is that a Taliban commander or foot soldier will have heard about an attractive young woman or a single young woman or girl. Often they're very young and they're in their teens, and they will approach the family, ask for the hand in marriage. The family will say no. So they turn up with reinforcements. They turn up with their mates, armed Talibs. Sometimes they turn up with a cleric in tow and they're married on the spot. If the family resist, they're beaten. And we heard so many of these cases.
Some of these women, like Mariam, who are being jailed for so-called morality violations, as you said, they're eventually released. Are they then accepted back into their communities?
There's such shame on having been imprisoned and accused of immorality that they can't leave their homes. They're completely ostracized. And listen, being accused of immorality, it's a bit like calling somebody a prostitute. Your life's over. Mariam and her friends told me they can forget any semblance of a normal life and a normal future. Life was over for them.
What about the men in the families of these women who are being persecuted? Are brothers and fathers, are they standing up for these women?
They're trying to, but the pressure and weight of society and the expectation of how women are to behave is so great. You're now risking your life.
I know you managed to get in touch with several activists in Kabul. Most feared meeting with you. One group, though, did allow you to attend their meeting and film them.
They were the first women we met willing to show their faces on camera. Before the Taliban took over, Lina was a lawyer.
She's telling you, in one fell swoop, everything was taken away. I'm confined to four walls like the prisoners I used to defend. Ramita, can women like her and female doctors and lawyers and police officers still work outside the home?
Lawyers are not allowed to. Doctors have been allowed back to work because they're needed. So we spent time in a hospital in Herat, in a burn unit, actually, where there were 11 resident doctors. Six of them were women. And they very clearly said to us, the only reason we're here is because the unit wouldn't be able to run without us. And the Taliban knows that.
Ramita, you were born in Iran. You're also British. Did your dual nationalities come into play in this story or weigh on you as you took these risks?
Well, I mean, it was really helpful because I look Afghan. I speak Persian, and the difference between Persian and Dari is a bit like French and Quebecois. I speak with an Iranian accent. I speak a little like a truck driver, actually. So. But it's interesting because Afghanistan is safer than it's ever been. So Afghans now and foreigners can travel across the country in a way that you've never been able to do in the past 20 years. There's no fighting. You know, there are no IEDs. The roads are really safe. But there are Taliban checkpoints everywhere. And people are stopped. And my brilliant director, Kareem Shah, is half Pakistani. So he wore local clothes and he looks like a local. And so we posed as a couple and we got through nearly all the checkpoints without any issue and problem.
What you did in this documentary was quite dangerous for you and for the women you talked to. Near the end of the film, one of the Afghan female activists named Arafa quotes from an Afghan poem. What is she saying?
She's saying, the only thing that is left is your voice. There is no reason to be silent. With the thread of your voice, sow the flag of rebellion. And actually, saying that out loud to you now gives me shivers. I haven't seen women this brave in 20 years of reporting. And Arafa, this young woman, was being monitored. The net was closing in on her. Her friends had been imprisoned. Yet she continued to go out and protest. And we, you know, I remember sitting with her and she was telling us how she felt about the Taliban and what they were doing and the reality of life for women in Afghanistan. And I kept saying, this is dangerous for you. And she kept saying, but I have to do this for my little sisters. It doesn't matter what happens to me.
We've been speaking with Ramita Navai, a correspondent for PBS Frontline. Her documentary, Afghanistan Undercover, premieres tomorrow, Tuesday, on PBS. Many thanks, Ramita.
Thank you so much for having me.
The World's Carol Hills. It's been 1 year since the Taliban retook control of Afghanistan and the U.S. formally withdrew its troops. Listen up all this month for our coverage as we mark the stunning events last summer. You're listening to The World. The Senate passes landmark climate legislation. Much of the world is pleased that the U.S. is trying to lead again, also knowing that Washington has far to go to get ahead of the climate crisis.
It's not yet enough. It is the beginning, and I think the rest of the world knows that.
Plus, a South African rapper steps out of Beyoncé's shadow to do things in a Joburg style. That's all still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. We're going to do something this week that we don't often do, revisit a series we reported some time ago, 2008 to be precise. The topic remains as relevant as ever, war, and more specifically, how they end. In 2008, the U.S. was in the middle of two wars, Afghanistan and Iraq. The question many were asking, how do they end? So we looked back in time. Many of us grew up with images of the end of World War II, Japan's official surrender aboard the USS Missouri, joyous crowds in Times Square. But taking a closer look, we found that most wars don't end this way. My former colleague Jeb Sharp examined a handful of cases, starting with Iraq. Here's part one of her reporting as it originally aired back in 2008, when the U.S. still had combat troops there.
In the spring of 2003, U.S. forces invaded Iraq and routed its army. 3 weeks after the capture of Baghdad, President Bush stood on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln and declared victory.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
For a brief moment, many Americans bought the idea. The war was over. But why didn't the war end with the fall of Baghdad? And why were we programmed to think it might?
A lot of Americans instinctively think of war as being a lot like a football game.
That's Stephen Biddle of the Council on Foreign Relations.
There's a goal. the enemy capital. Once you cross the goal line and you capture the enemy capital, you score more points than they did. You're declared the victor. The time runs out, the game ends, and you go home to cheers from the adoring fans.
And of course, the defeated side plays by the rules and accepts its loss.
In fact, real war doesn't work that way.
That's because real war is about politics, not sports. It was the famous 19th century military philosopher Karl von Clausewitz who said war is an extension of politics by other means.
What that means is that war is a way of figuring out who's going to rule and what policies are going to be adopted, and determining that outcome by a competition in inflicting and receiving violent force.
But appearances can be deceptive. The defeated side doesn't always lose.
Just because I've received some violent force, if I'm not yet ready to accept your politics as opposed to my politics, I don't have to stop fighting. I can keep going. I can change the way I fight.
Which is exactly what happened in Iraq. Instead of accepting defeat, the Iraqi Sunnis launched a devastating insurgency. U.S. blunders allowed it to thrive. Widespread looting became the symbol of the Bush administration's failure to plan for the aftermath of the invasion. At the time, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld dismissed it as par for the course for a liberated population releasing pent-up feelings. He accused the news media of exaggerating the chaos.
I picked up a newspaper today, and I couldn't believe it. I read 8 headlines that talked about chaos, violence, unrest, and it just was henny penny, the sky is falling, I've never seen anything like it.
Not everyone shrugged it off. Fred Eclay was Undersecretary of Defense during the Reagan administration. He's known among political scientists for a groundbreaking study of war termination, a book called Every War Must End.
You couldn't imagine General MacArthur moving into Tokyo and tolerating looting. No, he had a long parade of our tanks and guns and clearly established that we had the ability to control the situation.
Eclay says not only did the U.S. fail to plan properly for the post-war period in Iraq, it was overzealous in its purging of Saddam loyalists. You want to win over the population you've conquered, Eclay says, not alienate it. As we now know, Iraq descended into a vicious civil war. A complicated mix of sectarian groups struggled over the country's future. Prospects for an end to the conflict receded. Those who study how civil wars end have suddenly found themselves in demand. One of them is Harvard political scientist Monica Duffy Toft.
The most common type of ending is when one side wins, so you have a military victory. The second most common is negotiated settlements, and that's when the two parties agree to cease hostilities and form a common government. And the third is ceasefires or stalemates. So the violence ends, but the war itself, we don't talk about it having ended because it could reignite at any moment.
Iraq, of course, is both civil war and foreign occupation. Its end may not fit into a neat research category. Even Toft says the end of war is ragged and unpredictable.
There's no short-term fix. It's just incredibly messy and incredibly complicated. You know, it's a very famous book, Every War Must End, but some don't.
Nor is there always a winner and a loser. If peace does come to Iraq, it probably won't be in the form of victory or defeat, says Stephen Biddle of the Council on Foreign Relations.
To the extent that we eventually get something that looks like an end to the violence as a whole in Iraq, I think it will be because most or all of the many important actors within Iraq have come to accept less than their most ambitious ideal political solution.
That's certainly true for the Americans, Biddle says, who have long since had to trade rosy visions of Jeffersonian democracy for some semblance of stability. There's been stunning progress in Iraq in recent months, but those close to the action say the gains could easily be reversed. In any case, the end for Iraqis looks quite different from the end for Americans. Daniel Serwer directs the Program on Peace and Stability Operations at the U.S. Institute of Peace.
Talk to Iraqis. I mean, they see the situation so much better today than it was that they almost feel it's over.
And Serwer says even if U.S. troops do pull out in the next few years, aspects of the war will linger, perhaps for generations.
You know, the concept of the end is wrong. if what we're thinking of is the end as in the end of a movie, it doesn't happen that way.
It happens in a much more ragged way. In war, true endings are hard to pinpoint. For The World, I'm Jeb Sharp.
Jeb first reported our story back in 2008. We wanted to hear more from two people who were central to Jeb's reporting, and the conflict in Ukraine was top of mind when we reached out to them. Stephen Biddle, who today is professor of international and public affairs at Columbia University, and Monica Duffy Toft, who is now professor of international politics at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. I asked them how their thinking about how wars end has changed in the last decade.
Well, one thing's the same is that, you know, war, you know, at least for the last 50, if not 60 years, wars have been very, very difficult to win. I mean, the last victory, true victory, was World War II. I think what's changed is that I think authoritarian states, and here I'm going to put Russia's Putin in that category, and it's going beyond simply disarming its adversaries. And what we're seeing in this case is that it's trying to depopulate Ukraine. I mean, I haven't heard that term dead cities used before in modern warfare, and it's because he is trying to depopulate. And the reason is he can't persuade and change minds. And so now, because of nationalism, loyalties, emotional attachment, he's having to resort to sort of basically barbarism in order to try to get the Ukrainians to cow. And then the second is what the meaning of victory is. And what we're seeing now is the mediation of cyberspace, social media, however you want to put it, allowing for different leaders and populations to accept different interpretations of victory. And I think that you're only going to see that intensify. I mean, an interesting question is what if it were the case that Putin just declared victory? He's got control of the media space in Russia. And so I think that that has intensified this ability to sort of change the meaning of victory and sort of mold it to say, yes, we've won, and perhaps persuade the populations that that's the case.
What about you, Stephen Biddle? What's changed about your thinking about the end of wars?
Yeah, I think the principles of ending wars are universal, but I'm impressed by the way that the recent events have shown that the United States isn't the only country to screw this up and misunderstand this. We were pretty harsh back in the original show on the United States for viewing war as something more akin to a football game. That's not the way real war works. War isn't a game. If the defeated side doesn't accept the political settlement that's on offer, the war doesn't end. It just transmogrifies. It becomes guerrilla insurgency or other things. Today, we get the opportunity to observe Vladimir Putin making literally the same mistake, albeit at even greater human costs.
Mm. What's interesting about Putin, though, is that he had actually prevailed in prior conflicts, right? So in Syria, he came out ahead, in Georgia, Chechnya, and then in Ukraine in 2014, right? I'm not convinced that he knew how badly it was going initially. I mean, when you look at what was happening on the ground in February, the troops had been released with 3 days of rations and gas. And he expected a quick and decisive victory because he thought that the Ukrainians were going to greet him with sunflowers. And so now he's finding himself in basically a war of attrition, and the Ukrainians are on the losing end of that. And what's unnerving about that is that they actually did have their Vietnam, which was Afghanistan from 79 to 89. And so what's striking is that for a man who was actually pretty good tactically, that strategically he didn't think about the history from Moscow's perspective, particularly in Afghanistan. And I think part of the reason is that he had had these short, quick, limited military operations, Chechnya, Georgia, Crimea, and now he's in a full-throated war. And so the bottom line is I just wish leaders who control these large conventional militaries, and by the way, nuclear weapons, would understand that war just does not work. The data from the scholarly community is very clear that unless you want to decimate and kill off an entire population, people are going to fight back if given the opportunity. So what you have to do is deprive them of that opportunity, which means you have to kill them down to every man, woman, and child, which is why, in part, this war in Ukraine is so horrific.
And if Putin doesn't agree to stop shooting, the war doesn't end. A non-trivial number of voices in the American debate seem to presuppose that if Ukraine crosses the goal line, right, if they recover all their territory, then the game is over. They're declared the victor, the war ends, and Putin goes away and licks his wounds. That's not true unless Putin agrees. But the other side of the argument is that we should have a negotiated settlement and the U.S. should be pressuring Zelensky using our massive leverage to get Zelensky to agree to some negotiated deal. But if Zelensky were to accept a compromise deal that gave up any meaningful part of Ukraine's territory, he would be toppled. The outrage, righteous outrage on the part of the Ukrainian population would end his administration very quickly, and that deal wouldn't stand. So if we view war not as a football game, but as extending political contestation, you don't get an end to the war simply because you decide you want one at time T. At the moment, I would argue the conditions simply aren't ripe. It's hard for me to think of any policy towards this war that can end it in the short term.
Stephen Biddle is a professor at Columbia University in New York. Monica Duffy-Toft is a professor at the Fletcher School at Tufts University in Boston. Thank you both very much for rejoining us to discuss.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Marco.
Tomorrow, part two of our five-part series on how wars end as we look at America's Civil War. Depending on where you live, the heat might be getting you down this week, and it's only Monday. Some indirect relief is arriving, though. On Capitol Hill, the U.S. Congress is on the verge of passing historic legislation to tackle climate change, a version barely passed the Senate this weekend.
The Senate being equally divided, the vice president votes in the affirmative, and the bill, as amended, is passed.
Vice President Kamala Harris there breaking a 50-50 tie. To help us assess how this new climate deal measures up globally, we reached out to Rachel Kite. She's the dean of Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. She was also a member of the UN Secretary General's high-level advisory group on climate action. Rachel, some have called these $369 billion climate and energy provisions monumental. Others say they fall short of what's needed. What do you think?
Well, both's true. It's monumental in that the United States has not been able to pass climate legislation up to now. This is important. It gets a very clear signal into the US economy, but it's not yet enough, because if everything that's in there actually gets implemented, then the US gets closer to its target, but not all the way there.
So what do you see as the bill's main climate accomplishment? So what will, in theory, now get done that wasn't getting done?
There's very important clean production tax credits for renewable energy, for solar, wind, geothermal, for storage. Then there is an important set of credits in there for clean manufacturing, for all of the component parts of that renewable energy sort of revolution, and that much of that could be manufactured in the US. So solar panels, incentives for storage companies, etc., even for critical minerals, for the things that we need. Then there's energy efficiency in appliances, heat pumps, and then tax credits for people purchasing electric vehicles, and the creation of a green bank so that we can use public money to leverage private money into the green infrastructure that we need.
So we on the show really wanted to know how this legislation compares to policies across the European Union, for example. Where does the U.S. now stand in terms of ambition of government-funded plans?
85% of the global economy has committed to net zero by 2050. But what's been really important is to make sure we get on track and quickly. And so 2030 commitments have been the focus for the last couple of years. The United States made a commitment of 52% reduction in emissions by 2030. This bill, if enacted and then implemented, would get us closer to that, but not all the way there. The European Union has a 55% cut by 2030. That's what they're legislating towards. India just upped its ambition for 50% of its energy to come from renewable sources by 2030, which is a huge commitment by then. So major economies are trying to stay on track and are trying to really push forward action in this decade, in the 2030s, not just relying on that 2050 long-term target. But we're in the middle of an unprecedented debt crisis, inflation, food price hikes, and fuel price hikes with the supply shock coming from the pivot away from Russia. And so there is a lot of help that's going to be needed to help all countries succeed.
Rachel, as a former senior UN official, you've been at the table in climate negotiations. How far does this new climate deal go to restoring U.S. credibility as a leader on climate change?
It's the necessary nation. The United States is the second biggest emitter historically, and so it has to be at the table. And it's an incredible source of entrepreneurial vigor and technological prowess. So what this does is allow the U.S. diplomats and the extremely strong bench that the Biden administration has put in place, allows them to continue to engage and allows them to sort of talk with some kind of authenticity. It isn't just do as we say, it's do as we do. Without it, it would have been very difficult for the US to command that kind of authority. But it's not yet enough. It is the beginning. And I think the rest of the world knows that.
Rachel Kite is the dean of Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. She was also an advisor for the UK when the country presided over UN climate talks. Rachel, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
This weekend brought yet another round of violence between Israel and militants in Gaza, the most intense fighting there since that 11-day war last year. But this time the battle did not involve Hamas, which rules Gaza. Instead, it was the group Islamic Jihad that battled with the Israelis. The fighting killed at least 43 Palestinians, including 15 children. Hundreds more were wounded. On the Israeli side, at least three Israelis were seriously injured by shrapnel. With us now to unpack what happened is Hugh Lovett. He's a senior fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. Hugh, let's start with what caused this outbreak in violence. How did it start?
It all started with the detention by Israeli security forces of a senior Islamic Jihad militant in the Northwest Bank town of Jenin. Now, the arrest of this Islamic Jihad militant provoked a great degree of anger within the Islamic Jihad movement. And according to Israel, there was a specific threat that was issued by the movement against Israel, potentially relating to plans to commit some sort of missile strike, anti-tank strike from the Gaza Strip. At some point, Israel made a decision and decided to launch a preemptive attack against Islamic Jihad targets, which then forced Islamic Jihad to reciprocate through rocket fire.
Tell us more about Islamic Jihad. These are Palestinian militants. Just remind us who they are.
So Islamic Jihad has been around the Palestinian scene now for quite some time, since the 1980s, and it grew out of the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood movement, much like Hamas did, and so they kind of emerged at the same time. Hamas remains committed to Israel's destruction, as does Islamic Jihad. But I think the difference is that Hamas has developed more of a political and governance agenda. And also, of course, Hamas for the past 15 years has also had to govern Gaza. And I think this has forced Hamas down a more pragmatic path.
And how do Hamas and Islamic Jihad see one another? Is it a power competition or do they operate in any sort of partnership?
So there's certainly cooperation. So while Hamas did not participate in this latest round of confrontation because Hamas did not see it to be in its interests, the two organizations have fought side by side in previous wars. Generally speaking, Islamic Jihad is second to Hamas. It's Hamas that leads the way in confrontation against Israel. It's Hamas that usually sets the rules, and it's Hamas that usually decides when to escalate and when to de-escalate. But again, there is this competition because both, I suppose, are competing for, generally speaking, the same constituency, which is the religious conservative constituency. Both are also, to a certain extent, competing for foreign funding, Iranian funding. But certainly it's not always cooperation. At times we do see friction.
How was Egypt able to broker a ceasefire so quickly in this situation? And do you think it's going to hold?
Well, Egypt used its traditional role as a mediator of past ceasefires, its relations with Israel, its relations with Hamas, but also its longstanding relations with Islamic Jihad. All of this put Egypt in an important position to be able to broker this ceasefire. When it comes to the ceasefire between Islamic Jihad and Israel, the fundamental question at the moment is the fate of two Islamic Jihad prisoners. Will they or will they not be released by Israel? Their fate will likely influence the fate of the Islamic Jihad ceasefire and whether there is escalation, whether in Gaza or elsewhere, such as in the north of the West Bank.
The Gaza Strip has effectively been under siege for more than 15 years now. Infrastructure has been absolutely devastated. How long can the situation go on?
No one, neither Hamas, nor Israel, nor Palestinian Authority, nor the international community, can propose or is at least willing to propose a more sustainable political vision for the Strip. Everyone talks about the need for sustainable political vision, but no one is actually able to articulate what this would look like, let alone actually commit the political capital to make it possible. So obviously, Israel will need to lift the siege of Gaza, but clearly that will probably also require Palestinian reunification and reconciliation, so reintegrating Gaza into the governance and institutions of the Palestinian Authority. None of this is likely at present. Absent that, Gaza will remain trapped in this cycle of escalation and de-escalation.
Hugh Lovett is a senior fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. He's been speaking with us from London. Hugh, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Let's head to South Africa for our musical closer today. If Sesame Street were doing the global pop charts right now, they'd say the hot music is brought to you by the letter B. It seems this summer, with some exceptions, it's Bad Bunny, Burna Boy, and Beyonce monopolizing the hits. You won't break my soul, I'm telling everybody. Let's focus on that third B for a moment. Now I just fell in love, and I just quit my job. Beyoncé's latest release is Renaissance, and this track, Break My Soul, is everywhere, has hit number one from Croatia to South Africa, Lebanon, and North Macedonia, and hung in the top 10 for weeks in many other countries. That kind of dominance is a habit with each album Queen Bee puts out, but it's not just about her. Beyoncé's 2019 track, My Power, emerged from the energy and talent that came together for the Lion King soundtrack. With My Power, Beyoncé is barely audible, giving the mic instead to other female artists whose voices she wants to raise up. One in particular from South Africa who's benefited a lot from that assist. Child Sinelli, who got the outro verse on My Power. A barely 20-second appearance, but enough time that Moonchild Sinelli invited all sorts of attention. If you took your baby to 2021, if you still get hot, cause you're keeping them around, let it drip, honey, let it drip, let it drip, honey, let it drip. Moonchild came out this summer with her own album, Phases, songs in Xhosa and English, styles that run the gamut from house and rap, as she demonstrates in this Don't Postpone Joy ode, Let It Rip. Moonchild Sinelli definitely holds her own melodically. We leave you today with this number, where Moonchild embraces the Vogue style in South Africa for the past decade, the house music known as Amapiano. Jazzy, loungy, you can check it out in this tune, Favorite Regret. You're my favorite regret, my final reject, my package at compact, my ATM connect, my babe, you cannot compare. New music from South Africa's Moonchild Sinelli brings us to the end of this Monday edition of the show. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow. As funny daughters, funny mali. See a convert as funny party. When I so tight to you, Bok, we are landing as in Mali. As funny daughters, funny. From PRX.